Hi, my name is June Guinan. I'm an alcoholic and a pill addict.
Hi.
Hi. I'm really honored to have been invited here. I think this is a wonderful convention. And you know, back home, some of us have a saying sometimes, you know, I don't need a meeting, I need a convention. And for me, that was one of those weekends. You know, I need a convention, and it's wonderful to be here. I got sober in Los Angeles, and it's interesting. You know, you read the big book, and you hear different people talk at our conventions back home and everything, and you know that there are people from other places that are staying sober, but sometimes you just think that California is where AA is, and there's a couple of other people out there somewhere, and it's been wonderful to be here and hear you guys, you know, talk. I mean, you guys are saying the same thing that we say back home. Everybody that's shared and listening to all of you, it sounds just like AA back home, except for you talk funny, but the it's basically the same, you know, and that's a fascinating thing about Alcoholics Anonymous. I'd like to thank the committee very much for inviting me. You know, I remember one time I was invited to talk somewhere, and it was about 100 miles from my house, and the direction that it was on a Wednesday night, and we had to leave right in the hard traffic in Los Angeles, and it ended up taking us. It usually only would take 2 hours, and it ended up taking us 4 to get to this meeting. And I knew it was going to take that long. And that day, during the day, I remembered, you know, I was complaining. I didn't want to go talk, you know. I knew nobody was going to listen. I knew I was going to drive all the way out there. You know, I knew nobody else in AA ever gets asked to do anything. You know, they always ask me. And I went out to lunch with a real close friend of mine in the program that day. And we were coming back from lunch to her office, and there was a guy laying in front of the door on Wilshire Boulevard, which is a major street in Los Angeles. He was just laying in the street. And he kind of came to as we were walking by. And he asked us, he said, "Could you help me?" And we said, "Well, what could we do? What would you like us to do?" And he said, "I'd like to go to the VA hospital, to the detox unit. I'm tired of drinking." And it was just interesting that he would have chosen us, I mean, out of the people walking down the street. And so she went upstairs to call the VA to find out if this guy was a veteran so that we could get him into that program. And while she was there, I was sitting on the curb talking to this guy, and the police drove up. And I thought, oh, God, you know. And the police, both of them got out of that car, and they walked over, and they said, "Hi, Walter, how you doing?" And he said, "Oh, fine, how you doing, Bob, Jerry? It's good to see you, you know." So the guy, he says to me, "You know, what's happening here?" And I said, "Well, he asked us to give him a ride to a detox center, and we'd be more than happy to do that if that's all right with you." And he said, "Great, you know, that's about all we can do is take him down to the tank and hold him until he cleans up, so we'd just as soon have you do that if you, you know." And I said, "Well, fine." So my girlfriend had called the VA, and he was not a veteran, and but she had found another place that we could maybe take him to, and we drove over there. And there was a man in charge of choosing who, I guess, they would allow in, and we walked in there and introduced Walter and this guy. And the guy says to Walter, he says, "Walter, have you ever been here before?" And he says, "Nope." He said, "Well, you know, that's interesting, Walter. Let me go check." And he went back, and he came out with a file like this on Walter. And he said, "Walter," he said, "when you try and stop drinking, do you have any problems? Do you have any DTs, convulsions, anything?" He said, "Nope." He said, "Well, Walter," he said, "I was just looking at your record here, and it says last time you quit drinking, when you were with us, you went into DTs and convulsions, and we had to rush you to a hospital." And he goes, "Oh, I was just faking." So he said, "Well, excuse me for a minute." And I suppose he went back in the back to make their final decision whether they would admit Walter. And Walter looked at me, and he said, "You know," he said, "they're treating me like I'm some kind of an alcoholic or something." And he says, "Do I look like an alcoholic to you?" And I said, "Walter," I said, "I'm going to tell you, we just found you laying in the middle of Wilshire Boulevard, one of the largest streets in Los Angeles. I've never seen anybody that looked more like an alcoholic in my life, you know." And we were and as I was talking to him and thinking of the illusions and delusions that A talked about, that we have about ourselves, you know, and the way other people see us. But I sat there and I thought, as I talked to Walter, I thought, I wonder how long it's been since Walter's been invited to go 100 miles away and give his story. And I had to think about when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. I had not been invited to do anything but to leave in a long time by the time I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. And so it's a real pleasure to be invited to come to some place like Louisiana and be asked to share. Something else that has been wonderful for me about this conference already is that we had a fantastic speaker this morning. And, you know, in my sobriety, I've rarely heard a speaker that I have not identified with on some level. The funny thing about this morning's speaker is that basically he told my story, and so I think that you're going to be a little bit bored this afternoon when I tell you his story all over again. I identified myself as an alcoholic and a pill addict, and there's a reason for that. The reason is that I very rarely used alcohol without the use of drugs. The drugs that I took were barbiturates or downers or reds or yellows or sleeping pills, whatever name you might know them as. And I used the combined effect of those chemicals because they got me what I wanted, complete oblivion. And unlike many people in Alcoholics Anonymous, I did not go out there and party. I didn't have a good time. I was never a social drinker, not for one day. I just wanted complete oblivion, and that is why I drank. And I used the combined effects of those. And the reason I identify myself in that way, and I talk about it a little bit in my story, is because I have been told that I'm supposed to share my experience, strength, and hope. And that is part of my story. I'm not trying to impress you with the fact that I was a cool dope fiend or that I'm different. I'm just trying to tell you my story. And you know, sometimes when I first started to talk in Alcoholics Anonymous, there'd be some people and they'd come up and they'd make a big fuss about me talking about the pills and they'd say, you know, this is Alcoholics Anonymous and it's for pure alcoholics. And at first, you know, I thought about that and I later found out though that the only people who ever said anything about my talking about pills were the ones who were still taking them. So I happen to believe I was born an alcoholic. I don't get into any philosophical discussions about it. It's something I believe. And the reason for that is very simply there was something wrong with me before I ever took a drink in my life. The way that that first manifested itself was from the age of 5 years old, I became obsessed with the idea of suicide. And from that age, I started to try and kill myself in any number of ways. At the age of 5, I started to cut my hands and fingers and wrists with razor blades. I took overdoses of baby aspirin. But in fact, that did become my obsession. That became my number one obsession, was to die. And from the age of 5 years old, as long as I can remember, there was never one day, not one single day of my life, that I didn't want to die up until I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. Not one moment that I didn't. I spent every day praying to die, asking to die, or trying to do something so that I could get out. And of course, I knew that by taking the kind of pills that I took and mixing them with alcohol, I was running an extremely high risk of overdosing and dying, and that's exactly why I chose those pills and that combination. I started to use drugs when I was 7 years old, and I started to drink a year later alcoholically, and by the time I was 9, I had found the combination that I've already told you about, and I never changed it. I never altered it at all because, again, all I wanted was complete oblivion. I really just wanted to die. I didn't want to feel anything. You know, some people drank and they wanted to go out and feel good. You know, they wanted to change their feelings. I just wanted to shut them all out. I didn't want to feel anything. And I guess, you know, maybe I can give you a little bit of my philosophy as I grew up, the philosophy that I developed for myself, maybe so that you can see where I was coming from. I grew up in an alcoholic home. My mom's an alcoholic. And I grew up with a lot of violence. And I grew up with a lot of the broken promises that we all experience by knowing an alcoholic in any way. I looked around, though, when I was a kid, and I was a watcher of people. And as I watched the people, in my entire life before I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I never saw a man cry. As a matter of fact, I never saw a man show any emotion whatsoever except for rage. I saw them hit people. I saw them fight. I sometimes saw hostility. But I never saw them show any kind of pain, ever. I never felt that anything mattered to them, whether somebody came or went out of their life, whether somebody died or not. I didn't think that it ever mattered. And on the other hand, I saw women, and of course I saw them experience rage, but I also saw them, experience the pain. I saw the things that happened in their life hurt them, and I saw some of them cry, and I saw some of them even have nervous breakdowns. And I looked at these two groups of people, and I decided immediately which one I wanted to be like. And I spent my entire life trying to emulate what I thought a man was. I think to a large extent, basically what had happened was, somewhere along the line, I got the idea that to feel anything at all meant that you were weak. And in my life, there's never been anything I've been able to tolerate less in anyone than weakness. And in myself, I had a tremendous amount of sensitivity, you might say, when I was a kid. I can remember going to school and somebody would call me a name and I could feel it inside. I just feel myself fall apart and want to start to cry. And I hated that about myself. And I knew that meant that I was weak. And I began at the age of 5 years old to hate myself because I was weak, because I was everything that I found disgusting. And I think that that began the feelings of wanting to die and wanting to check out because I couldn't be what I wanted to be. And alcohol enabled me to not feel anything. It enabled me to not feel weak anymore. I wasn't sensitive when I was drinking at all. Nothing mattered to me. I didn't care who came or who left. You know, I didn't care what they did. And that's how I wanted to be. When I drank, only men were my friends, only guys. Most of them had been in prison. Most of them, or some kind of an institution, depending on their age. Most of them carried weapons. Most of them had tattoos. Most of them were very violent. And those were the people that I admired. I wanted nothing to do with anybody that I thought was kind or sensitive, because I thought that they were fools. I thought that basically life had to do with you better get them before they get you. And I wanted to make sure I was on the right side in that that spectrum. When I was a little kid, and they said, June, you know, what do you want to be when you grow up? I said, I want to be a guy. And they told me I couldn't, because it wasn't as easy back then as it is now. But I settled for the next best thing. I tried to become a tough broad. That was the only option available to me. And it's fascinating, you know, the lengths that I was willing to go to prove to people that I was tough. For one thing, you know, that's interesting. In the last few years in Alcoholics Anonymous, I've noticed that a lot of women have gotten tattoos. And generally, the tattoos that the women I've known have gotten have been butterflies, flowers, you know, perhaps a little panda bear, you know, something like that. I mean, they're kind of cute, you know. Now, if they'd been giving tattoos when I was on the streets, I'll tell you right, I'd be standing up here and I'd have a shark on my arm right here, and it would swim when I did this. And I'd have a battleship on my chest, you know, or maybe a canoe in my case. But, I mean, really, you know, that's not that funny. I would have been willing to do anything if it could have convinced people that I was tough. And, you know, like Eddie talked this morning, I frequently had a black eye and a swollen lip. And I deserved them all the time. You know, it wasn't the people were picking on me. But I had developed a certain psychology even in being beaten up. In my life, I've never had a fight with one person, ever. It's not a good idea to have a fight with one person. If you have a fight with one person and you lose, people are going to think you're not very good. So I never did that because I was a tough broad. I only fought with groups of five or more. And I always lost. But everybody looks at you, they think, how could you win with five people jumping on you, you know? And then you must be pretty tough or five people wouldn't have had to jump you. And that was kind of the way I tried to skate by. The last time I got beat up, my five best friends came to the door, and they knocked on it, and they said, listen, June, if you come out of the house tomorrow, we're going to beat you up. So I got up the next morning, and I got dressed, and I walked out of the house, because nobody was going to think I was sitting in my apartment afraid to come out. Nobody could scare me. And I came outside, and they started to follow me. I was walking down the street, and I thought as I walked down the street with them following me, I could either take the street or I could take the alley. And I thought, you know, if I don't take the alley, they're going to think I'm afraid to take that alley. And I don't want anybody to think I'm afraid to do anything. And I took the alley and they beat me up. I remember laying in the alley and these five girls punching me and knocking my head against the asphalt. And for whatever reason, they had chosen that day, all they wanted me to do was to cry. And I didn't cry. And I don't know how long they hit me. It's funny, time's rather elusive at moments like that. But they finally got bored and they left. And when I got up from that fight, if you'd asked me, when I had my black eye and my swollen lip and blood running down my face, I'd have told you I won. Because I didn't cry. I didn't give them what they wanted. And I suppose if they'd have chose to continue to beat me until I died, I'd probably be dead. Because I think that it was that important to me to not let anybody think that they could make me feel or do anything, ever. And I think it's really absurd today. I mean, if somebody walked up to me, they said, look, June, I'm either going to punch you in the face or you can cry a couple tears. I'd cry a few tears. What's the big deal? You know, but at that particular time, I'd rather have died, you know. And it's interesting. I did not drink or use my chemicals for a tremendously long period of time in comparison to most of the people that I've met in Alcoholics Anonymous. And yet, by the time I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I had absolutely no place left to go. And I suppose in many ways that's the best way time and the best way to get here. I think my mother had been in and out of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And she came back to the program and she brought me to a meeting one night. Not particularly because she thought I had a problem. She knew I had a lot of problems. She didn't think that drinking was necessarily one of them. She brought me to a meeting and the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous started to happen that night for me. even though I didn't stay sober. Because what happened was I walked in the meeting, and there in the meeting, sober, was this guy that I admired more than anybody else in the whole world. Because he'd been in prison, because he had tattoos, because he carried a knife, because he was very tough. And he was sober. And that made an incredible impression on me. And I spent the evening talking to Paul, and then I went out and I got drunk the next night. And then I came back to some meetings, and most of the time I spent talking to Paul. I was just fascinated that somebody this tough that I admired, somebody who wasn't weak, not weak like me and weak like my mother, but somebody who was strong, was sober in this program. I spent some time talking to him. I thought, you know, I'm too young. And I spent a lot of time trying to convince Paul that I wasn't an alcoholic. And Paul never said anything, you know, but I spent a lot of time trying to explain to him. And I later found out that non-alcoholics don't have to spend any time convincing people that they're not alcoholics, you know. And finally he says, you know what, June? They tell us in Alcoholics Anonymous that we can't diagnose anybody's disease but our own. So, but in your case, I'm going to make an exception. He said, I happen to believe that you're an alcoholic. He said, because I've seen the way that you drink. And he said, and I also happen to believe that if you don't come into this program and take what these people have to offer you, within a period of 6 months or less, you're going to be out on the streets, you're going to be shooting drugs, and you're going to be selling your ass. And I knew he wasn't trying to scare me. He wasn't like a high school teacher standing up there talking about the dangers of alcoholism. He was stating facts. He was stating things that he'd done. He was saying many things that I had already done, too. And I listened to him, and I started to raise my hand in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I think that what happened was, at that time, when I came into the program, there were some people who didn't know very much about the traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous, which I think are particularly important, especially the third tradition, which states that the only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. And when I first came into the program, I was young, and they'd never had anybody my age in their meetings. And a lot of people didn't think I could possibly be an alcoholic. And there were some people who asked me to leave the meetings. And again, I'm sure that's just because they were ignorant as far as the traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous were concerned. But I took that as, you know, I've been thrown out of every place I've ever been. And I just thought Alcoholics Anonymous didn't want me either. And so in this two-week period of time, absolutely everything but Alcoholics Anonymous had already been removed. I had, although I never had a fight with one person, I was extremely violent towards my mother, and I attacked her on a number of occasions. And at this particular period in my life, she didn't feel that she had to subject herself to that anymore, and she threw me out of her home. And I left. My family had not talked to me in 3 years and would not, under any circumstances, speak to me, either on the phone or in person. I'd been in 6 foster homes. I'd been asked to leave every one of them, and none of them would take me back. I tried to get into drug rehab and alcohol recovery homes in the Los Angeles area, and none of them would take me, either because of my age and some just because of my attitude. I already told you what happened to my 5 best friends. And so I was faced with the only choice that I've ever had, and that was suicide. And I went over to a friend of my mother's, and I went into that woman's bathroom, which was the first place I went at anybody's house, to see what kind of pills they had that I could steal. And I found the kind that I needed, and I overdosed. And before I passed out, I went to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And a funny thing happened in that meeting. I walked in and I laid down in the meeting. And I don't know about down here in Louisiana, but in L.A. where I got sober, we almost never call on people to talk who are laying in the meeting. And for some reason, they asked me to talk, and I didn't say anything except for that they realized that I had taken something and they took me to a hospital where I was being given medication to make me throw up, and that was explained to me that the pills I had taken were to slow down my heart. And had I been there 5 minutes later, I probably would have been in a coma that they couldn't have brought me out of. And to tell you, quite honestly, I don't know exactly what was different about that overdose from all the others that I'd inflicted upon myself. But I know that there was something different. Because since that time, one day at a time, I haven't taken anything at all that affects me from the neck up. And my sobriety date is July 13th, 1972. I know what I was trying to say in that meeting, though. You know, no matter what came out, no matter how incoherent it was, I know what I was trying to say that day. I think it's kind of important for me to say it in meetings when I'm asked to share. I think what I was trying to say is, you know what, I don't know if I've gone as far as some of you people have. And then again, maybe I've gone just a little bit farther than some of you. I don't really think that's very important. The point is, I don't have any place left to go. And I don't know if I want what you people have. I don't even know what you have. I just know I can't stand what I've got anymore. And you don't have to tell me if I go back out there on the streets I'm going to die. Dying doesn't scare me. Not one bit. Dying's what I've been trying to do since I was 5 years old. What scares me is maybe I can go out there and live for another 20 or 30 years, like some of you people have. And that's what I can't stand, is living out there that way anymore. So please let me stay. And the people of Alcoholics Anonymous have let me stay. And, you know, there's been a lot of people in Alcoholics Anonymous that would still come up and, you know, say things like I was too young. And I remember one of the favorite ones was they'd say, you know, kid, I spilled more booze on my tie than you ever drank. And I finally just looked at them and said, you know, if you hadn't spilled so much, maybe you would have gotten here sooner. And, anyway, I suppose because of my experience, the third tradition is real important to me. Because it states that the only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. And that means that nobody can throw you out of AA, ever, for any reasons, if you have that desire. And you know, it's interesting because when they were writing the traditions, they didn't always decide that. And I'd like to read you a little bit about what they were thinking about when they wrote this third tradition. That we were resolved to admit nobody to AA but that hypothetical class of people we termed pure alcoholics. Except for their guzzling and the unfortunate results thereof, they could have no other complications. So beggars, tramps, asylum inmates, prisoners, queers, plain crackpots, and fallen women were definitely out. Yes, sir, we'd cater only to pure and respectable alcoholics. Any others would surely destroy us. Besides, if we took in those odd ones, what would decent people say about us? We built a fine mesh fence right around AA. And as they thought about that, they decided to write the third tradition. It's interesting because if they had let that list stand, certainly I and none of my close friends would have been allowed into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I walked into this program, and I suppose it's rather ironic the way that things worked out for me. I came here, I was 13 years old, I was 87 pounds, I had a black eye, I had a swollen lip, I had the clothes I had on, and that was it. I had no money, no family, no friends, no home, nothing. Just what I had on when I walked through the meeting. And I didn't have shoes on, I wouldn't have worn them if I did, but I didn't have any. And that's how I arrived in Alcoholics Anonymous. And it's interesting, what's ironic about the way I arrived in Alcoholics Anonymous is that I was greeted with a tremendous amount of love by many people in Alcoholics Anonymous. However, because of my attitude and the life and philosophy that I had, I was completely unwilling to accept any of it at all. I was hostile, to say the very least, when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I smoked 3 packs of cigarettes a day, and I lit every one of them myself. Nobody lit any of my cigarettes. And I also smoked cigars, big cigars. Not cute little lady-like cigars. I wanted big cigars. And I also carried a pipe. I had a motorcycle chain around my wrist and a motorcycle jacket that said on the back, do unto others and then split. When I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I had a very limited form of communication. Basically, it consisted of a tremendous vocabulary of foul words, and the ability to cut people down verbally. That was an art that I had tried to work on all my life, to be able to insult people and tear them down verbally. And it was something that I thought I was pretty good at and was very proud of. And that was the only form of communication I had. The closest thing to a compliment I ever gave in my life was that was a good fight. And other than that, everything else was a put down. And if I wasn't putting you down, I was putting me down. And that was the only form of communication I had when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. And because of that, because of my language, because of my abusive way of speaking to people, and my outward way of manifesting hostility, and my cigar smoking, I'd like to assure you that if you choose to act that way in Alcoholics Anonymous in order to have people let you alone, that it just might work to some extent. There were times I could sit in a meeting and have an entire row all to myself. However, I found a sponsor, or he found me, and he was considerably more hostile than I was and wasn't at all thrown off by my actions. And basically what he would do is if I got out of hand, he would grab me around the neck and threaten to kill me. And I know it doesn't say that anywhere in the book, but that worked for me. That was something that I understood, you know. You know, I have to be particularly grateful for the people who tolerated me when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I remember one guy in particular. We were talking a few months ago, and I said, you know, Jim, we haven't talked in years. And he said, don't you remember why? And I said, gee, I really don't. He said, when we were brand new, we all went to a meeting. I said, after the meeting, we were in the coffee shop, and at the coffee shop, I said something you didn't like, and you put your cigarette out in my shirt. And And he said, then on the way home, I was getting out of the car and you slammed the car door on my head. And I don't remember doing that. You know, I'm sure all I was trying to do was let him know I liked him, you know, because when I was growing up, you know, if I liked somebody, I'd just punch them all the time, you know. And I mean, I didn't waste my time on people I didn't like. But that was really how I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. Nobody had ever told me how often you should brush your hair or take showers or brush your teeth or anything. I knew nothing about those kind of things at all. I didn't know how many meals a day you were supposed to eat. None of that stuff. I was completely ignorant as far as living was concerned. However, I was fairly good at surviving. And that's how I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. A survivor, an animal in many respects. And I just hung around and was tolerated and loved by many. I was told to get the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I have been a thief all of my life. I've been stealing since I was 5 years old, and I didn't see any reason to change here in Alcoholics Anonymous. And at my home group in particular, they used to say, if you don't have enough money, we'll make credit arrangements. If you're too afraid to talk to us, steal it. But I thought if I stole the big book from an AA meeting, it would jinx my sobriety. And so I went down to the library in Santa Monica, near where I live, and I stole the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And while I was there, I picked up a copy of the 12 and 12, you know. No sense making two trips. And I never felt bad about that because the library had lots of books, you know, and I didn't think there was anything wrong. And, of course, after I'd been sober for a couple of years, I realized that I needed to make an amends for that. I needed to. And I went down to the library, and I had about 30 other books that I had stolen since I was 6 years old and just kept in my closet. And great classics like Misty the Seahorse, you know. And I loaded these books up, and I took them down to the local library, and I explained to her that I was a member of Alcoholics Anonymous and that it was necessary for my sobriety to return these books, but that I'd like to make payments because they want 3 to 5 cents a day, and I'd had some of the books 11 years. And she said, that'd be fine. She said, you know, it's really funny, though. She said, I used to work in this library, and this man came in. He'd had this book for 35 years, and he said the same thing you just said. He says, you guys must do this all the time. The funny thing that I learned from that experience was that there really isn't anything that I've done or thought about doing that somebody else in Alcoholics Anonymous has not also already done or thought about doing. I was told to get active in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I did that. I went to a meeting every night. During most of my first year, I went to 21 meetings a week. And I got to most of them early, and I left most of them late. And the reason for that was not because I was a wonderful AA member. It was just that I was plain terrified, and I didn't have any place else to go. I came to Alcoholics Anonymous not nearly in as bad a shape physically as many of the people that I have seen since I have been here. But mentally, I was up there with the best of them. I came to this program, and they used to make me a greeter at the door. And all you had to do was stick out your hand, and somebody would come up and say, hi, I'm Sally, and I'd say, hi, I'm June. And then somebody else would say, hi, I'm Kathy, and I'd say, hi, I'm Sally. Because the last thing I heard was all that was left up here. That's about it, you know. And I'd sit at home, and I'd try and read the big book, and I'd read the same sentence, and I'd read it over and over and over. And God, I couldn't remember from the first word to the last. You know, and it wasn't always like that, and I was able to see, you know, when I that some of the alcohol and the chemicals that I had used had certainly affected my mental abilities to a large extent, at least at that particular time. But I just kept going to meetings, and lots of them, and I was told to do everything that I was ever asked to do in Alcoholics Anonymous, and to never say no. And that's been something that I have tried to live by in my sobriety as much as possible, you know, to do what I was asked to do. And it's interesting because in my life I've always been irresponsible, I've always been undependable. There's never been anybody who's been able to count on me for anything. And in Alcoholics Anonymous, I was taught here to be responsible and to be dependable. And it's interesting how those things that I have been taught in the meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous have branched out into other areas of my life. So that in my job, I've been employed there for 3 years, and I've never not shown up, and I've never called in sick, and they depend on me. They know that when I'm on the schedule, I will be there, and I never thought that would mean anything to me, for one thing. It was certainly not something I would have asked for when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, and yet that's something that that makes me feel good today, to know that they can depend on me and that I am responsible in things that that I undertake to do, to a large extent anyway. I came to Alcoholics Anonymous with a seventh grade education, and I refused to go back to school under any circumstances. And so I got a job working in an answering service, answering people's phones. And it's interesting because with my attitude, I've never understood why I wasn't fired, because if somebody called and they weren't nice to me, I'd just hang up on them. And I don't understand why I was able to stay, but I managed to stay at that job for quite a few years. And the best thing about it was that I could work whatever, I could go to work and change my schedule according to meetings, because they were open 24 hours. And so I could work 3 hours and then go to a meeting and come back and work five or six more or whatever it was. And it worked out real good for me. When I was sober a couple of years, I got an opportunity to go to school and learn how to be a secretary. In my entire life, there's nothing I ever wanted to be less than a secretary. You know, it just was never even on my list. But I learned, you know, I just thought that I didn't want to work in this answering service all my life either, and so I decided to try it. And I went to school, and they have all these classes that you need to learn if you're going to be a secretary, and I did all right at most of them. Had a little trouble with typing. I started out, I typed 17 words a minute with 9 errors. And I went to school for 14 months, one day at a time, and at the end of that time, I was typing 37 words a minute with 19 errors. And they just told me, you know, I was never going to make it. They would never give me the degree that said secretary. I was inept. And but they said that they thought I could get some kind of an office job with some of the other skills that I had learned. But before I did that, they thought I should take a test, which they call a GED. And if you pass this test, it gives you an equivalent to a high school diploma. And so I went over and I signed up to take this test, and it's on 5 different areas that you'd learn about in high school. And I did the first 4 parts, and I did okay, but the 5th part was math. And I thought they'd start out with addition and subtraction, which is all I know how to do. And they started out with algebra. And then they started doing things that I couldn't even pronounce, let alone do. And I couldn't believe it. I remember one of these things, they had a rectangle, and then they had a line drawn across the rectangle, and they wanted to know how many feet was in one of those triangles. I started drawing little pictures of feet. I mean, I swear to God, I have no idea how you're supposed to figure that out today, you know? So I knew I was in trouble. And I looked, and all the answers on the test were A, B, C, or D. So I started talking to my higher power. I said, look, God, I'll tell you what I'm going to do here. I'm going to go through this test, and I'm going to pick lots of A's, you know, for AA. And I hope you know your math. I think everybody here should know that God's as bad at math as he is at typing. But somehow we managed to pass this test. And then came one of the first traumas in my sobriety. I think that the reason I was able to get sober as young as I was, and when I did, was because of the way that I felt about myself. You see, by the time I was 5, there was nothing about me that I liked. Nothing at all. I didn't like where I lived. I didn't like how tall I was. I didn't like being thin. I didn't like having curly hair. I didn't like how sensitive and weak I was. And those are the first recollections that I have of myself, was not liking myself. And the longer that I was out there and I drank and I did the things that most of us do while we're drinking, the less I was able to like myself. So that by the time I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, there's no way, even today, I can put into words the amount of self-hatred that I felt for myself. I just know that because we have a lot in common that you know what I'm talking about. And by the time I came to this program, I didn't look in mirrors. I didn't want to look in anybody's eyes, but particularly I didn't want to look in my own. And I didn't look in mirrors. And that had a lot to do with why I didn't take showers or baths, too. You know, not that they were never available, but because I didn't want to get that close to myself. When I would wash my arm, I would feel like throwing up. Because I knew what I was. You know, I come from a little town called Venice, and it's at the beach. And most of the people, or a lot of the people down there, they're on welfare, and they're poor, and they're out of prisons, and they're out of a lot of different lower spheres in life. And that's where I came from. And I knew that that's what I was. I'm a dirty little Venice broad. And I knew that was what I was when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I also knew that Alcoholics Anonymous would never change where I came from. It would never change what I was. And it certainly would never change the things that I had done. And so I knew that the hatred that I felt for myself was never going to get better. And that had a tremendous amount to do with the way that I reacted towards the people in Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't want anybody to put their arm around me. I didn't want anybody to tell me that they loved me. Because I knew that that was impossible from what I was. You couldn't love me if you knew what I was. There was just no way, you know. And you couldn't touch me because I couldn't even touch myself. And that's how I felt. And, you know, when I was a year sober, almost, we went to a convention. It was a young people's convention, and it was held in San Francisco. And it was at a hotel called the St. Francis Hotel. And I haven't been there since, and so I'm sure my recollection may be a little bit off. But I'd never been in a hotel in my life. I'd never been on a trip like that. I'd never really left Los Angeles in my whole life when I got sober. And we drove up at this hotel, and they had people parking cars for you. And I'd never seen that in my life. And I watched everybody walk into this place, and there were big, thick carpets and red velvet drapes. And everybody was dressed up, and they were so respectable. They were good people. And all my friends got out of the car to rush in there for the convention, and I wouldn't go in. And they said, "Come on, Jean, we got to go to the convention." I said, "No, I can't walk in a place like that. People like me can never walk in a place like that. And if I go in there with you, they're going to come over, and they're going to ask us to leave. And I don't want to embarrass you. I don't want to go in there." And I sat in the car for a couple hours, and I cried because I knew I'd made my friends feel bad, but I knew I couldn't go in. And they finally talked me into going in, and I went in there, and I went into the room, and it's the only convention of Alcoholics Anonymous I've ever attended where I didn't go to one meeting. I didn't come out of that room because I knew it was not good enough to have even been able to sneak in there. And that's a little bit of the way that I felt about myself for a long time in my sobriety. And those are some of the feelings that I had to deal with. And when I finished the secretarial course, even though I was not a secretary, it was time to go out and get a job in the citizen-y type world. My form of communication with people was not that much better, so I didn't feel very capable of talking. I didn't know how to wear anything but T-shirts and jeans. I'd never worn anything else, really, and I didn't know how to dress to go out and look for jobs with those people. And I knew I wasn't as good as they were, you know. I wasn't good enough to stand on their carpets in their nice offices. I knew they weren't like me. And it was interesting, you know. Some women on the program took me out and helped me pick out some clothes. And it was like Halloween to me, you know. I dressed up like a citizen, you know. And I went out there, but I knew I wasn't. But I still had to go. They told me in Alcoholics Anonymous I had to do the footwork, and I had to go out there and get a job. And I went out there, and I tried, and I got hired. I got hired in an insurance company. I couldn't believe it, you know. I got a job, and I was so square. And I went out there, and I went to work every day. And on the seventh day, they called me in the office, and I thought they were going to give me a raise. And they fired me. I said, "I'm sorry, we're going to have to let you go." She said, "You don't have enough experience." And not only that, she said, "You don't seem to have any common sense whatsoever." And I didn't even know what common sense was, you know. But I went across the street, and I immediately called Los Angeles Central Office. And I said, "This is June. I'm a sober member, and I've just been fired. What are you going to do about it?" You know, I thought we'd pick it. I'd been sober a couple years, and I never heard anybody being fired sober. Ever. You know? And I called my sponsor, and I told him, I said, "You know, I never got fired before I came to AA." And he reminded me I never had a job. And anyway, so now I had to go out and look for another job. And I found myself, and I swear I don't remember how this one came about, but I found myself one day filling out an application in a bank. And I could hardly contain my laughter knowing that I'd been a thief all my life. I thought this was funny. But I got to a point in the application where it says, "Due to the fact that as a bank employee it's necessary that you be bonded, we're going to do a thorough background check." And I thought, oh, no, not me. I don't want them looking into my background. First of all, they call one library, and I've had it, you know. And but I went ahead, and I did. I turned it in, and not only did I get hired to work in a bank, they put me to work in the vault. And I didn't even know if the program worked that good, you know. But it did. And somewhere during that time while I was working there, I wanted to go back to school. And I just took two classes at night, and I worked full-time. And I liked it. You know, I didn't really have any plans. I just took a couple classes, and I did the same thing the next semester. And I ended up getting laid off from that job in the summer, about 3 weeks before school was going to start. And I applied for a loan, and I got it. And it was a small loan, but I also got a job that could work around my hours if I went to school. And I started to go to school full-time. And that was fun. I was able to work the one day at a time part of the program in school, better than I'd been able to do in a lot of other areas in my life. You know, I'd go to school every day, and I'd go to classes, and then I'd come home, and I'd do my homework, and then I'd go to a meeting. And everything seemed to fall into place for me, and I did that one day at a time. And at the end of 2 years, I graduated with what they called an AA degree, which I thought was apropos. My family was there, and both of my sponsors, and some of my friends. And when we were all walking up to get our degrees, they announced that I was graduating third in my class out of 500 people. And when I walked up there and I thought, this is not possible. You know, I came to AA just a few years ago and I couldn't even read from the beginning of one sentence to the other. And I didn't have any doubts that I did that. I knew Alcoholics Anonymous made that possible. Because I couldn't do anything at all
And here I was, you know, graduating with a college degree. And you know, man, when I walked through the doors of the program, if they'd have said, look, do you want a Harley-Davidson motorcycle or a college degree? I'd have taken the motorcycle, you know. I didn't want a college degree. And yet it meant something to me, you know. And I went on and I wanted to go on to school. And I applied to a couple of universities, thinking whichever one accepted me would be the one I was supposed to go to. And I got accepted at all of them. And I talked to my sponsor, and we narrowed it down to two, UCLA and USC. And my sponsor said I would have to make the final decision. And I just couldn't. I just didn't know which one to go to. And I heard about this thing called a God bag. And what you do is you take the answers to your problem and you write them down on separate pieces of paper and you just put them in a stack, shake them up, and reach out and pull one out. So I wrote UCLA on a piece of paper and I wrote USC on a piece of paper and I stuck them in the bag and I shook them up and I reached in and I pulled out one. And all my life I'd wanted to go to USC. And I reached in and I pulled out UCLA. So I thought, two out of three. Anyway, it didn't work. The bag does not work, really. It's something like, you know, there used to be a story. This guy's walking along on a cliff, and he just suddenly trips and he falls. And he manages to grab onto this little tiny branch, and he's hanging on. And it's a long way down, and the branch is creaking while he's holding onto it. And he yells, God, if there is a God, do something. And this voice from up above says, do you really believe in God? And he says, yeah. He says, do something. And the voice says, do you really believe in God? And he says, yes, I really do. And the voice says, then let go of the branch. And he's holding on to this branch, and he looks down at how far it is, and it's a long way down. And he looks back up, and he says, anybody else up there? And there's been times in my sobriety where I've had a pretty clear idea of what I'm supposed to be doing, and I was just kind of hoping maybe somebody else would come up with a better idea. Anyway, though, I ended up at UCLA, and in June of 1980, I graduated from there. And somewhere along the way, I don't know exactly when, I had come upon a dream that I had had for an awful long time. And again, in sobriety, I've been taught that that you can try for your dreams, that you can do the footwork, and that oftentimes they come true. They sometimes don't come true exactly the way you might have planned them, but they do come true. And I did the footwork for this dream that I had. And about a year and a half, 2 years ago, I got a telegram telling me that a couple thousand people had applied to UCLA's School of Law. And unfortunately, they could only accept 400, but that they had chosen me as one of those. And that's what I've been doing for the last year and a half, is going to law school. And I can't believe it. You know, first of all, I plan on spending a lot of time in court, but never on that side of the table. And I know that I'm not supposed to be there were it not for Alcoholics Anonymous. But there's absolutely no way. Nobody comes from where I came from and gets to where I am unless they have something like Alcoholics Anonymous. I think that it's been interesting, you know, the last year and a half. It's been interesting in a lot of different ways. For one thing, I forget oftentimes how, you know, it's funny, I don't know very many of you at all. I don't even know most of your names. And yet, I've told you more things than anybody in my family knows already, you know. The thing is that I've learned in Alcoholics Anonymous that there's a lack of judgment here that I've never experienced anywhere else. The funny thing is that sometimes I forget that when I'm out there. And I remember at law school I had an interesting experience. I was talking to a guy about a movie, and it was called The Rose. And it's the story of Janis Joplin's life, supposedly. And he was telling me that he'd always idolized Janis Joplin, and I thought that was kind of unusual because he didn't seem like the type of person that would have, really. And he said, the thing is, though, you know, he said, there was something about that movie that really bothered me. And I said, what was that? And he said, well, he said, this one point in the movie, she's about to have an affair with this man. And she says, before we do, I have a confession to make. So when I was in high school, I slept with the whole high school football team. And the guy told me, he said, you know, if that's true about Janis Joplin, he said, I just don't think I could ever respect her. And I looked at him and I said, you mean you'd hold one football team against a girl? And I knew. Immediately, I said, never tell this man my story. It's funny. I came to Alcoholics Anonymous single, and at 13, I suppose that's a rather good idea. However, in sobriety, I've had to learn to date. And that's probably one of the hardest things that I've had to do, you know. And usually, if you hang around the program long enough, you'll have an AA date. And I don't know if you have those down here in Louisiana. We have a lot of them back in Southern California. And what an AA date is, a guy asks you out and he takes you to a meeting. And where else would you go? Then after the meeting, you go to coffee and you talk about the meeting.
And by the time he takes you home, you don't know whether to kiss him goodnight or say the Lord's Prayer. So, I remember one of them was in particular. I was out on the date, and we were at the coffee stage of our date, and he said, "You know, I really like you." And I said, "Thank you." He said, "But I like your girlfriend over there at the next table better. Do you mind if I go sit with her?" And I said, "No, not at all," and he did. And I went home, and I thought things through myself. And for me, that's a very dangerous thing to do. I've had some tremendous problems, you know, in my sobriety, but the solutions that I have come up with beat them all. You know, you just couldn't believe. But I thought things over, and I got up the next morning, and I went down, and I tried to join the United States Air Force. I figured, screw them, you know. And the Air Force wouldn't take me, and then I called my sponsor, which is what you do. If you're new and the Air Force won't take you, you should call your sponsor. And I told my sponsor, I said, "You know, everybody in Alcoholics Anonymous has a relationship but me. I go to meetings, it's like Noah's Ark. They're arriving in pairs, you know. It's not fair." And he told me, he said, "You know, Jeannie," he said, I promise you, you're going to meet Prince Charming. So you may even be on a white horse. The problem is, before you meet Prince Charming, you have to kiss a lot of toads." And I got a sign, and I put that up in my house, and I thought, you know, every time somebody break my heart, I'd think, just another toad on the lily pad of life. And just kind of move on, you know, and roll with it. And the funny thing about my sobriety is that I came here and I didn't have a sense of humor about anything, particularly if it involved me. And the interesting thing, probably the greatest gift I've been given here is a sense of humor, particularly with respect to things that are happening in my life. And the funny thing, too, is that once you can laugh at something, it seems to take some of the importance away from it, some of the pain that is involved. In my sobriety, despite my jokings or whatever about relationships, I really did not change many of my old ideas as far as people were concerned, and especially as far as feelings were concerned. And I resolved, even here in Alcoholics Anonymous, to not care and to not feel and to not get too close. And I tried to maintain that for as long as I could. And in my sobriety, I've only had one time where I've ever had a desire to drink, really. And that was when I was 7 years sober. When I was 7 years sober, I got emotionally involved, and after 30 days, he left me for a younger woman. And I refused to cry, to tell anybody that he had hurt me, or to let him know under any circumstances. And I refused to talk to God, because I knew that this was another one of God's jokes, that God had done this to hurt me, and I just decided that was it, you know. And I hung on to every old idea I had had all my life through that experience. And what ended up happening for me was that I came down to a very big decision. And I think it's one that all of us make. And I just suppose it happened for me when I was 7 years sober. I think many people make it a lot earlier in their sobriety, if not right when they first come into the doors. And the decision that seemed to be before me was that I could choose to be the person that I had tried to be all my life before coming to Alcoholics Anonymous, the person who didn't care, the person who never got hurt, the person who nobody could affect in any way emotionally. But if I wanted to be that person, I would have to do the things that I had always had to do to be that person. I would have to drink. It was the only way I was ever able to not feel things and to not care and to not get hurt. On the other hand, if I wanted the way of life that Alcoholics Anonymous had taught me and was exemplifying by its members, I was going to have to give up those old ideas. I was going to have to go ahead and get out there and get hurt and be vulnerable and have my feelings hurt and have my pride, you know, shot all to hell sometimes and you know, maybe have people laugh at me and think that I was too sensitive. And that was a choice that I decided I'd make when I was 7 years sober, that I would rather stay here in Alcoholics Anonymous and be weak, as I had always defined weak. And it's interesting, my definition has changed to some extent. I don't really think that feeling things are weak anymore. As a matter of fact, it talks about in the book, your whole outlook upon life will change. And mine has, and so have the people in my life. When I first came to Alcoholics Anonymous, and for some time after, all the people in my life were hostile. None of them showed any emotions. None of them would ever have let you know that you hurt their feelings, even if they were dying inside. You know, and that's how I was trying to be. And today in Alcoholics Anonymous, there are no people like that in my life. There just aren't. All of the people in my life, be they men or women, are very sensitive people. You know, they feel things, and there are things that matter to them. And I no longer think that those people are weak, nor do I think that that's weakness in myself. And I'm not sure exactly how that happened. I think that it happened to a large extent by watching the people in Alcoholics Anonymous, by the example that you have offered me, by just doing what was in front of you and watching you in meetings over the years. I don't know, maybe a year or a year and a half later, I met somebody in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I fell in love, and we got engaged. And I've never been engaged before, and it was wonderful. And then he left 3 days later, and I couldn't believe it. I just couldn't believe it, because I'd never been happier, and because I'd never in my life told anybody I cared except for him. He was the only person that I ever let know that. And the interesting thing was that it wasn't nearly as hard as the time before when I had tried to not feel anything. And I have this very neurotic thing that I've done all my life. Whenever anybody's left me, I always go and I look in the mirror. And this is before sobriety and since. I always go and I look in the mirror, and I talk to myself, and I say something like this. I say, look at you. Look at what you are. Look at the things that you've done. You wonder that anybody would leave you? You should be lucky anybody would have stayed and tolerated you as long as they did. Because you're nothing. You're a dirty little Venice bride. And nobody would ever want you. And you should just be lucky that they tolerated you as long as they did. And this time I went in the mirror and I looked in there. And I couldn't say that anymore. Because I knew that that wasn't really true. That for the first time in my life, because of the way I've been taught here in Alcoholics Anonymous, that I have something to give to, you know. I remember being at a conference a couple of years ago now. And I was at a banquet. And everybody was real dressed up. And I was looking around at everybody in the room, and I was looking at the way they were dressed and all the things they were wearing, and everybody just looked fantastic. And I looked at everybody's dress in the room. And you know, it was really interesting. I didn't want to be wearing anybody's dress but mine. But I checked again, just to be sure. But I didn't. I liked my dress. And I looked around again, and do you know, I didn't even want to be blonde or stacked. I couldn't believe it. I wanted to be me. I wanted to look like me for the first time in my entire life. And not only that, but I asked myself a couple of other questions. And you know what I came up with? I wanted to be living the life that I was living. I wanted to be feeling like I was feeling. And when I walked through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, you could never have told me that I would want to live, ever. That feeling of wanting to die would not be with me all the time. And it hasn't in Alcoholics Anonymous. I want to live. I enjoy living. And I take the good with the bad, and there's been some of both in the years that I have been sober. I think, though, that the greatest gift that I've been given is the fact that I like myself today, a lot of the time, you know. I like the things that I'm doing. I like the life that I'm living, and I never thought that that could happen for a person like me. I think sometimes, you know, I have the gratitude span of an ant. And the way I know that is if I walked out of here today and I found a $10 bill, the first thing in my mind would be, thank you, Father. And the very next thought would be, you know, it could have been 100. And that's just the way that my mind works. And in my sobriety, I've had to be very careful of that. And I think that's why it's real important for us to stay close to meetings, no matter how long we get sober, so that we remember where we came from and where we should be, were it not for Alcoholics Anonymous. And I think, though, sometimes, you know, I start thinking, you know, I'm awfully young. Maybe that was a phase I was going through. Maybe I was sowing my oats, you know? And then all I have to do really is I get down the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous and I read the third chapter in particular where it states that the obsession, rather, of every abnormal drinker is that someday he will control and enjoy his drinking. And if there's one thing I have been able to come to resolve within myself, it's that there's no way I could do both at the same time. I could either control or I could enjoy. But those two do not go together for an alcoholic. And I think, you know, what happens is, you know, other times I start thinking, you know, I'm awfully bright. You know, I mean, obviously I'm bright. And, I mean, look at my grades. And look at the school that I'm going to. And really, maybe this, you know, this Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, maybe I could have done it myself. And then all I have to do is go down to my home group down in Venice and go down to where I lived all my life and check around with some of the people that I grew up with. And without having to be dramatic or exaggerate by any means, I can tell you that there isn't another woman that I grew up with that right now isn't dead in an institution or out on the streets in Venice turning tricks. And although a lot of them have boyfriends, most of them beat them up on a real regular basis. And they live in homes where the gas, the lights, and the phone are never all on at the same time. And the reason I know that is because that's where I came from. And that's where I'm supposed to be today. Exactly. I'm not any
smarter than any of those women are. I'm certainly not any prettier than any of those women. And God doesn't like me any better than he likes them. There's just one difference between me and them. Alcoholics Anonymous. Thank you.